From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello, I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Joel, by the time most of our listeners hear this, it'll be late May. Dayton will be a week in the past. But it's really the beginning, for all intents and purposes, of Hamfest season, from now all the way into the fall. And, of course, with most Hamfest comes the flea market. And I thought it might be appropriate to discuss, some flea market shopping tips, if you want to call it that, really. Because there are bargains to be had out there, and there are also some real dogs to be had out there.
Well, that's certainly true. And I would point out that your view was kind of New England-centric in a way. The people in Florida have great flea markets in January and February when we're curled up.
Yeah, so, they've got warm weather down there,
yes,
don't they?
Yes, they do, and other places in the country, too.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. So flea markets are happening all over, as frequently happening as fleas are, I think.
Yes, precisely. And I love flea markets. I see all sorts of stuff there. I mean, at Dayton a couple of years ago, and I was sorely tempted. I saw a guy selling Geiger counters out of the back of a pickup truck. No idea how well they worked or if they worked, but boy, he was doing great business. I mean, hand over fist.
Given the current news in the international world,
I just couldn't think of a ham application.
Well, no,
for
but
them.
you might need one. You might. Never mind. We won't go there.
But in all seriousness, many hams look for transceiver bargains, coaxial cable, microphones, you name it. But in the case of transceivers, I mean, flea market vendors don't have AC plugs in most cases to fire up the radio and show you how it works. Is there anything that would give you fair warning, perhaps, that a radio might be not quite what it seems?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, the good news is you have somewhat more evidence than you do if you look at an internet auction site, in which case you get the hopefully not terribly overly retouched photos of the good-looking parts of different radio equipment.
Yes.
At least at a flea market, you can actually see the equipment up close. So now, if you can power it up, that makes a big difference. And I guess I'm thinking if I were really wanting to buy a 12-volt transceiver, I would be tempted to bring along a little emergency lighting battery or
like a gel cell or something
like that, so you could power it up.
I didn't think of that.
But, you know, of course they say, oh, well, I didn't think to bring the power cord or, you know. The And so you can actually do some testing to a certain extent, even in that kind of environment. If you can power it up, I have a little handheld signal generator that I got. It was an old Elecraft kit. They have fancier ones available now, but this was a fairly straightforward one. Put out a S9 or S1 signal on 40 meter CW. And of course it had harmonics, so you could switch it between levels. So you could you can use it for S meter testing, but in a radio you're thinking about buying, you can use it to see, you know, is the frequency it's reading the same as the frequency I'm sending? Is is it hearing it at all? Is anything happening? Do the controls work? So, you know, if you can get power to it, that provides a good way of finding out what you've got, at least on the receive side. Your little gel cell battery probably won't let you transmit much, and you probably didn't bring along your cantenna with you either. But a transceiver has many common things both to transmit and receive. So if it receives well, you have some hope that it could transmit well as also. If it doesn't receive well, it doesn't really matter if it doesn't transmit well.
No.
So it gives you one out of two at least.
Do you have a rule of thumb like you won't even consider a transceiver older than a certain age?
You know, that's a good question, because one of the big problems with transceivers is, let's face it, everything can fail eventually. And if you buy something that's no longer in current production, you have no guarantee that the manufacturer can even help you with it or be willing to help you with it. They tend to say, well, we're going on to the next one and we can't support that one. That's not a real knock on the transceiver manufacturers. The part supply issue is a big one. They go to new generations of parts. The manufacturers of integrated circuits and transistors and whatnot stop providing them, or they all have to go to lead-free solder and the parts are no longer available. You can't get this, you can't get that. The transceiver manufacturers are kind of in a bind for being able to support these things. Now, it happens that there are some independent service people that specialize in particular manufacturers' equipment, and they had the foresight at some point to buy up a whole bunch of parts when they were available with the thinking that sooner or later people would have transceivers and have problems, and then they can continue to support them. So all is not lost if the manufacturer can't support it anymore. But that's a big issue. To my way of thinking, it's not so much a matter of the particular age. It's a question of knowing which transceivers manufacturers will still support. Because if they don't, then you have a boat anchor on your hands. Even though it's lighter than the old boat anchors, it still can't do a lot more for you than that.
Well, speaking of boat anchors, now let's say that you look at a transceiver that is an all-tube model or mostly tube model, and the seller says, hey, it's all the original tubes. Is that necessarily a good thing?
Well, you know, here's the thing. It's interesting that you mentioned that because tubes are still available. You might not be able to get an integrated circuit that's 5 years old, but you can get a tube that's 50 years old, and most vacuum tubes are available at very reasonable prices. If you look at some of the people that deal with them, they'll sell you a new old stock. That means it's new, not that it was made last week, but it was has never been used. It's old stock. It's been in the box, sitting there on a shelf, gathering dust since 1947. Chances are it will work. And, oh, by the way, I've got equipment in my station going back to the World War II era. We're still using the original tubes, and they still work. So old tubes do not necessarily fail. Some are more likely to fail than others. But if you look at a 6AU6, which was a very popular IF amplifier or RF amplifier tube in many receivers. It's a miniature tube in the, let's say, 60s, 70s era. You can typically buy one of those for about $2. I'm guessing this is off the top of my head, which is about what they sold for back in 1974. Hmm. Except $2 back then is probably worth $20 today.
Yes.
And the tube is not selling for $20. It's still selling for $2 or around there. I mean, these are round numbers. It's just amazing to me that you can do that. So if you're interested in that kind of equipment, you should think about buying a tube tester.
Which you can probably also find at the
flea market. I bought one at a flea market, and it actually worked for many years. It's acting kind of strangely now, but it's probably been in my basement for 25 years.
Well, that would do it. Yeah.
But all the parts in an old vacuum tube set are relatively straightforward to get: resistors, capacitors, tubes, and they're also accessible. They're on terminal strips usually. You can unsolder them. You can measure them. You can get to them. You can identify what they are. You can buy one. Used to be you'd buy them at Radio Shack if they're still around when you get this recording. But if not there, someplace else, you can buy that kind of component off the shelf without a great deal of effort. So in a very real sense, the old vacuum tube gear is easier to deal with. There are some exceptions to that. Power transformers are generally available but hard to find and expensive. And a few other specialized parts, IF transformers and so forth, that can require a significant effort. But by and large, most parts from the vacuum tube era are still available, and they're reasonably priced. In fact, you go to the next flea market table, and they'll have a gazillion tubes and a gazillion resistors and whatever else. And so, yeah, they might have my basement up there someday.
Well, now, speaking of the next table, you know, for an imaginary flea market, you move down to the next table. You see accessories. You see SWR meters, keyers, whatever. Any particular precautions there? Or?
Well, it comes down again to the technology. If you're looking at something that's electromechanical, like a key or paddle, the key issues are, what does it look like? I mean, the contacts are probably a little corroded and need a little cleaning. But in terms of value and what you should pay for it, it's more a matter of how is the chrome plating looking, and if there is any, and is it pitted? Is the paint scratched? Does it look like original paint? If you're interested, if you're a collector, you got to look at these things. In terms of technology, again, if you look at an old keyer, I have a Hallicrafters TO keyer from 1955 with vacuum tubes and relays, and it still works fine. If I bought a new keyer, I'd be worried about whether somebody applied the wrong voltage to the output transistor and blew it up.
That's true, yes.
I mean, that kind of thing. So, you know, the technology is as much of an issue as anything else. But most stuff can be fixed. It's just a question of how much trouble it is to fix it.
Well, Joel, let's take a break and hear from DX Engineering, and okay. We'll be right back.
Okay, I'll be here.
Remember your first contact? The excitement of that first CQ? The exhilaration of making your first QSO? At DX Engineering, we know that feeling too. That's why we've committed to making your on-air experience the very best it can be. DX Engineering ships quickly, which means less station downtime, and we have free shipping for almost any order over $99. We've recently expanded our inventory, so you don't have to wait for the gear you need. DX Engineering has introduced all new radio products and revived legendary brands, all with the goal of helping you enjoy amateur radio. Most importantly, the DX Engineering team is here to help you. You've got a team of highly experienced hands ready to work out technical issues, answer questions, and help you optimize your station performance. That excitement you felt from the first contact, it can happen again and again with help from DX Engineering. DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
And we're back, Joel, in our imaginary flea market. We're moving farther down the aisle here, and we've come upon coaxial cable. Big spools of it.
Oh, you know? My. Yes, that's a real red herring. I mean, that the problem with coax cable is it all looks nice and black.
Yes.
But the early old coax cable typically had, and we talked about coax issues some time back, but as a refresher, the big issue is what the outer jacket is made of. And if it's early PVC-1 contaminating type material, the plasticizer from the outer jacket will migrate through the shield, interfering with the shield's operation, and it'll let moisture in, and the whole inside of the cable can be a disaster. And yet, it still checks perfectly with an ohmmeter. This still has continuity from end to end and insulating properties between. It just doesn't act like coax cable anymore very much. So it's very tricky. If you can tell what part number it is and know that it's a current production and it's a non-contaminating jacket cable, and if it looks like it's in decent shape, chances are it's okay. But it's a little tricky to buy just the off-the-shelf, whatever's on the table, coax, and think you've got something that's really worth taking home.
Yes. Now, what if it has connectors? Should you spool the shell of the connector off and just look at the soldering job, or what?
Well, if they're UHF connectors, one thing you can do is you can take the just roll the shell back and look at the holes and see if it looks like it's soldered well. But that's really not a good test because no. It's quite possible to solder across the holes and not make any contact with the shield at all. You can, if you hold the coax tightly and move the connector in your hand, if it moves without pulling hard against the shield, chances are it's soldered. But if it just moves back and forth, then chances are the shield is not connected at all.
No.
And it's very hard to tell. I mean, in a way, you're better with coax that doesn't have connectors because at least you can see the color of the shield. It should be copper-colored and not black, for
yes.
example. And similarly with the inner conductor. But, you know, it's hard to tell what the condition is the whole way down.
Now, let's say the same guy that's selling the coax and the big spools, the big wooden spools, so he's got some antennas laying there, too. Maybe a tri-bander that's been disassembled. Anything to watch for there?
Well, it's good to have an ohmmeter at hand. I mean, the typical
something else in your pocket.
Yeah, well, but they aren't very big, and you could probably buy one two tables down if you didn't think to bring one. No, I've had good luck. I bought a tri-band trap antenna from a fellow staffer many years ago, and it had been at his house for 25 years and in his garage for 10 more or something. You know, I put in a fair amount of effort because it has the usual kinds of problems that aluminum has after many years of use. It gets corroded. The joints get kind of tight and hard to take apart. Now, if it's taken apart, that's a little easier. But what I did is I used sandpaper and a Dremel tool to get all the joints cleaned up, reassembled it using stainless steel hose clamps, checked all the connections to the traps, and the trap should measure 0.0 ohms end-to-end in most trap configurations. That isn't 100% check of the trap, but if it doesn't do that, it doesn't have continuity through the coil.
Yes.
And that indicates a problem. When I put it back together, I used no-corrode conductive grease between all the joints. So the next time it was taken apart, it would come apart, and it would not corrode like that. It would make good contact. And I've been using it happily for, I don't know, probably 5 or 6 years, and it works very well.
So you wouldn't have any qualms about necessarily buying an antenna at a flea market then?
No, but I would assume I would have to spend a weekend in the garage with sandpaper and safety glasses to get it cleaned up, and I would have a few cuts on my hands.
You had mentioned volt ohm meters, and that brought something to mind. Again, we're journeying down the aisle here. The next table has test equipment in particular, and I see this a lot for some reason, oscilloscopes. Once again, we can't necessarily fire it up, especially if they're older oscilloscopes. What about those?
Well, again, you look at the generation. There's a lot of old commercial equipment that was given up on because they couldn't afford to calibrate it or whatever. And, you know, they have plug-in amplifier sections that may or may not make contact when you plug them in. There's a lot of issues. I mean, if they're low enough in price, but, you know, you're taking a gamble. If you say, well, let me say I buy 10 oscilloscopes at $50 each, am I better off than buying a lower quality oscilloscope that I know works for $50, I don't know, or $500. I think you're taking a gamble. And I've lucked out a number of times. But, you know, it's much better if you find one at the dump and can bring it home for free. Let's put it that way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Every now and then you hear stories about that. If the person that's selling it at a flea market is a local ham and you're in your local area, you have a lot better chance. You can say, well, look, I'm happy to take this, but if it doesn't work, can I bring it back to your house and get my money back and see what they say? They probably know whether it works or not.
Yes.
And they're,
I would hope.
The usual thing is, oh, well, it worked the last time I turned it on, which was in 1967. And I unplugged it, and it's been sitting in storage. You say, well, that's fine. I'm happy to turn it on for you, but if it doesn't work, can I bring it back and get my money back? And that makes a big difference in what kind of a gamble you're taking.
Yes.
Especially if you get the guy's call sign and make sure you know where he really lives and so forth. Write down his license plate number and a few other things.
I had a member email me recently with a good question, really, concerning flea market. He was in the market for some toroid cores so he can make some common mode chokes. And he knew that, let's say, type 43 or mix 43, as they're called, was the type of material, composite material that he wanted. But he was rightfully concerned about being able to trust flea market tables. You know, there's a sign and it says type 43, or maybe it's type 31 or whatever. There's really no way to know for sure, is there?
I think that's true. Some of the manufacturers have color coding on them, but I don't think there's a standard among manufacturers, so that a red dot might be mix 43 on one manufacturer and mix 61 on another. Mm-hmm. You need to know what that is, and if you know what the manufacturer is, of course, they don't say on the coil itself.
No.
If they're in packages, sometimes the packaging is indicative if it's the original manufacturer's packaging. On the other hand, if they're cheap enough, again, you can take them home and you can wind a couple turn coil and make some measurements with your antenna analyzer on the inductance you get, and you can decide, you know, what it is or close enough to what it is to make it useful, and then mark it yourself with a I like the silver Sharpie type marking pens for writing on dark things like coax cables or whatever.
Yes.
And then you can go back, and next time you want to do it again. You know, if it's not broken, and I've found through experiment that if you drop a ferrite core on the concrete basement floor, it shatters. So you don't want to buy one of them, but I think it's hard to imagine one that would be in between, you know, that would be sort of half shattered and you wouldn't notice it. So if it's in solid condition, it is some kind of toroid that you can use somewhere. So if you buy a bunch of them, and if you can devise a measurement scheme, you can categorize them yourself and have them in stock for whenever you need them.
Now, let me put you on the spot here. This is the final question for you, in a way. Is there anything, Joel, that you would never shop for at a flea market that you just would categorically rule out? I'm not going to go to a flea market and buy X.
Cotton candy.
Cotton candy.
No, I guess I've gotten well, one of the problems I have personally is that my basement is overstocked. So I can't bring something into the basement unless I take something out. So I have to say to myself, what am I willing to take to the dump or take to a flea market in order to bring this in? And that puts a little focus on what you're thinking about. But again, if it's old gear that looks like it's in good mechanical condition, I figure I can probably fix it. If it's new gear, I have to figure out, well, am I willing to take the gamble unless I can test it? And if I can test it or have a good warranty or return policy, I'll consider it. So I don't think it's anything I'd categorically say I wouldn't buy that I can think of right offhand.
Not even old computer components?
Well, I would only buy an old computer component if I needed one. Again, I have a basement full of old computer components, so chances are I don't need them.
How about that 5-inch floppy?
I have plenty of them, and I even have one or two PCs with those. I even have some PCs that only have 5.5-inch, or was it 5.25?
Or 5.25.
Inch floppy. I don't have any 8-inch floppy deck machines at home, but I've got two or three that do 5.25. In fact, if anybody'd like to make me an offer, I have some really neat computer collectibles.
Take them to the flea market, Joel.
Yes. Well, you know, the problem with those is that I've found the electronic stuff tends to keep working. But I've noticed that 5 1/4 inch floppy drives, for example, after 10 or 15 years, seem to stop turning. And they still look the same outside, and the computer still works fine. But if you have, like, one of my first IBM PC, original PC, you can't talk to it if you can't put a floppy into it.
No.
There's no way to talk to it. So I guess you could use keyboard keystrokes, but if you can't bring up an operating system with the floppy, it's not going to do anything.
A couple of weeks ago, we had a member send us a log, and for some reason, he sent it on a 5 1/4 inch floppy. And we were running all over the building trying to find a 5 1/4 inch drive that we could use to read that thing. We finally located one, and the good folks in IT were finally able to get it to read. But it just goes to show you how technology moves along.
It certainly does. And nowadays, the thumb drive is the medium of choice, and that works very well. And the capacity of that compared to a 360 kilobyte floppy is just amazing to consider.
All right, Joel, are you ready for a question?
Sure, why not?
Well, Al M1AW asks, there was a discussion on a mailing list recently as to whether a multiband vertical antenna could work with elevated radials for higher bands and grounded radials for lower bands. This is not exactly my situation, as I have elevated radials trimmed to resonance on all bands, but it still made me wonder about the effect of connecting the junction point of the radials to ground. This is an interesting question. I've never considered that.
Well, it's a good question because an antenna with elevated radials works very well if you can have elevated, resonant, insulated radials above ground a few feet or higher. The antenna actually will work much better than it will with radials on the ground or buried. In terms of the antenna efficiency, it takes about roughly 60 buried radials, quarter wave or longer, to work as well as 4 elevated resonant radials. So the problem, of course, with elevated radials is you have people walking into them, deer catch their antlers on them, and things like that. So having them 8 feet off the ground is a good number. I like that number because unless you have a lot of basketball players or giraffes in the neighborhood, people are not going to run into them too much. If you do that, you get a couple benefits. You get the increased efficiency, and the other thing is the peak of the radiation elevation lobe drops down. So for a ground-mounted vertical with buried radials and a good, 60 radials or so, the peak elevation lobe is at about 26 degrees, which is not bad, depending on the ground connectivity and so forth. On seawater, it's right down at the horizon, but for most of us, it's about 26 degrees. You take that 20-meter antenna up 8 feet, and it drops down to 20 degrees. So that's an additional benefit. So having a elevated radial antenna is good. Now, an advantage of the ground-mounted antenna is that you sort of have built-in lightning protection, is that everything can be at ground potential, depending on how you feed it, and that provides a path for lightning, which is very handy. Al was wondering about his situation with the antenna at, say, 8 feet and the ground connection to ground or to ground radials below the antenna, what the difference is. Well, not only does it not hurt, it actually helps a little bit. So you can run a wire vertically from the base of the antenna down to ground, and that will help you with some lightning protection. If you have radials there for a lower band antenna, it actually makes the 20-meter antenna work even better. It's not a big deal. I ran some numbers. I put a model together. My version of EasyNeck allows me to model buried radials as well as elevated ones. And if you had 4 elevated radials connected through a vertical wire below to the ground radials below, you would get a gain or an intensity of about 0.73 dBi. With the buried radials below the ground plane but not connected, you get an intensity of 0.57 dBi. So grounding the elevated base to the buried radials gets you a bit more than 0.1 dB improvement. Not too much, mm-hmm. But if you looked at that same antenna without any buried radials below it, the gain would typically be about 0.3 dB. So 0.2 to 0.3, depending on how many radials. So just having the radials there below the antenna makes the antenna work better, which is kind of interesting and surprising.
Yes.
It's not a big deal. It's half a dB. But it definitely is true that having the radials below the antenna helps, and connecting a ground wire to them helps even a little bit more. So between all that, you get maybe half a dB of improvement. I mean, someday that might make a difference. Most days it won't, but every now and then it'll make a big difference. So it certainly doesn't hurt, and it can help a little bit to have that situation.
Well, that's great, Joel. Thank you.
My pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.